continue with this archive show. This is the prepared portion of One Step Beyond for July 17th of 1988, and this is going to go into the archives as our material concerning the shooting of President Reagan in March of 1981, as well as some of the background on George Bush's possible connections to the assassination of John Kennedy, and some of the other interesting possible machinations behind the scenes for election 88. We're now going to talk about a subject that we spoke at great length about last week, not only in the prepared portion, but also in a long call with someone who took issue with some of my conjectures concerning the death of a key Latin leader named Willy Velazquez. We're going to talk about Velazquez's death and review some of the salient facts concerning his proposed work for the Dukakis candidacy. This was cut short, obviously, by his death at the age of 44 of galloping cancer. Cancer of the kidney, too, by the way. First of all, the situation in Texas with regard to the Democrats' proposed electoral strategy should be borne in mind against the background of the current discussion. Reading now from the San Francisco Examiner of Tuesday, June 28th of 1988. This is an Examiner News Service's story, Dateline Washington headlined, Texan named Democrats keynote speaker. Texas State Treasurer Ann Richards, a popular orator in her home state but a virtual unknown nationally, will deliver the keynote address at the Democratic National Convention on July 18th, Democratic Party Chairman Paul Kirk said Monday. Richards, 54, joins fellow Texan Jim Wright, House Speaker, in a high-profile role at the nationally televised event. Wright will chair the convention. When you look at the Electoral College map, Kirk said, referring to the state's 29 electoral votes, you can't do enough or say enough about the importance of Texas, unquote. Kirk said Richards had been picked to, quote, set the tone for Democrats in Atlanta and to draw the distinctions between the party of the working American people and the party of the establishment. And then he goes on to say, Ann Richards is a mainstream Democrat and a fiery populist from Texas, one of George Bush's adopted states, Kirk said. Now, last week we took a look at the proposed southern strategy of Michael Dukakis, which was going to depend in considerable measure on drawing out the Latino vote in the Southwest and West in order to counter the traditionally conservative white vote in the southern states, which obviously would work to the benefit of George Bush. Now, Willie C. Velazquez was head of the Southwest Voter Registration and Education Project in the Southwest. We're going to talk about this last week's broadcast, and I will contact Paul at Archives on Audio and see if the Willie Velazquez material, in fact, I will see to it that the Willie Velazquez material from last week's program is included as a supplement to the broadcast this evening so that those people who eventually hear this program on tape can catch up with the audience here, the original KFJC audience. Now, Willie Velazquez had exerted a very profound effect on the participation of Latinos in the American political process. He was going to go to work for the Dukakis campaign. He was diagnosed in the third week of May as having cancer of the kidney, was given 6 months to a year to live, during which time he wanted to devote to helping Michael Dukakis win the election. Unfortunately, he died in less than a month, again, of galloping cancer of the kidney. This deprived the Dukakis campaign of a key aide, and it also deprived the progressive political forces in America of a very, very important participant. It should be noted again that, as I noted at the top of the broadcast, in 1954, Freedom of Information Act documents revealed that the CIA had, documents from 54 revealed that by 1954, the CIA had perfected a means of giving people cancer. In the archive show concerning our tiff with Reed Urban of Accuracy in Media, we went over some of that same material again. It is a matter of public record that the U.S. National Security Establishment had a means of assassinating people by cancer as early as 1954. With the advances in medical technology affected since that time, I think we can safely assume that that ability is considerably greater now than it was before. The question is, was Willie Velazquez's death by cancer a natural death or, as I believe, an assassination, one of a long and tragic series of assassinations which have affected the American electoral process during the last quarter century? A key article about the Willie Velazquez, an obituary, an article about William Velazquez's life, his work, and his death, and his possible impact on the 88 elections, appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, July 13th of 1988. This is a story by Beatriz Johnston Hernandez. It's special to the Chronicle, and it's headlined, Drive to Register 5 Million Hispanics. By the way, Beatriz Johnston Hernandez is a writer-editor for Pacific News Service. Few leaders have affected the political map of America in recent decades as profoundly as William C. Velazquez, founder and director of the Southwest Voter Registration and Education Project. His death at 44 on June 15th has made Chicano attorneys, advocacy groups, and other supporters even more determined to perpetuate Velazquez's work by registering a record number of Latinos and American Indians before the election in November. Mourned by thousands, eulogized by Michael Dukakis as a great man, unquote, Velazquez is remembered as both a visionary and the key to the political empowerment of Mexican Americans in the Southwest and West. Most significantly, through his project, Velazquez gave Chicanos of the early 70s an alternative to the badly defeated Chicano movement, which, in its most extreme form, sought political empowerment through segregation and confrontation. By the time of his death, U.S. Latinos were part of a political movement sweeping Latin America that chooses the vote over guns as the road to power. When Velazquez founded the Registration Project in 1974, Chicanos, angry over the disenfranchisement of Mexican Americans, had briefly taken over Catalina Island and declared it a sovereign nation. They had baptized the Southwest with the mythical name of Aztlan and had formed the marginal Raza Unida Party. Approximately 2.5 million Latinos were registered to vote in the United States, but rarely voted. Cities and towns throughout the Southwest with majority Mexican-American populations were run by Anglos. The handful of Mexican-American elected officials were condemned as sellouts. 6 years later, by the 1980 presidential elections, Velazquez and his project had increased that figure to almost 3.5 million. Velazquez's goal was to reach a registration of 5 million Latinos, roughly one-fourth of the country's Latino population, by this November's election. The project is well on its way to meeting this goal. Now, again, he in 6 years increased the Latino voter registration from 2.5 to 3.5 million. And as we looked at last week, the number of Latino elected officials in the United States increased by 82%. Summing up the work of Willie Velazquez, Ernie Sotomayor of the Dallas Times-Herald said, "Because of his work, Hispanics have a potential to decide whether Michael Dukakis or George Bush will become president," unquote. Again, because of his work, wrote Ernie Sotomayor, associate editor of the Dallas Times-Herald, Hispanics have a potential to decide whether Michael Dukakis or George Bush will become president. And another comment here. San Francisco Supervisor Jim Gonzalez said, "We won't see someone of his caliber pass this way again in our lifetimes." And again, in the information from last week's broadcast that I'm going to have included as part of the archive show, Willie Velazquez, in the 6 years of the Southwest Voter Registration and Education Project, increased the number of Latino elected officials in this country by 82%. Now, again, in last week's broadcast, we saw to it that Velazquez had decided that during the closing months of his life, he was going to go to work for George Bush. And recall that we also looked last week at the fact that Latinos were seen as a key strategic element in George Bush's electoral strategy in the South and Southwest. Of the loss of Willie Velazquez and its possible significance to the Dukakis campaign, Newsweek wrote on July 11th of 1988 in its Periscope column as follows, this entitled Loss of a Leader. Again, Newsweek, 7/11/88. "The untimely death of Hispanic activist Willie Velazquez last month could undermine Democratic chances in the Southwest, particularly Texas and California, strategists for Michael Dukakis now fear. Founder of the successful Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, Velazquez met Dukakis in 1981 at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School, both were lecturers, and planned to become his deputy campaign manager. Quote, for a guy who devoted his life to nonpartisan activities, so to suddenly leave and go to work for Dukakis would have sent a wonderful... Let me try this again. For a guy who devoted his life to nonpartisan activities, to suddenly leave and go work for Dukakis would have sent a powerful message," unquote, says Dukakis aide Jose Villarreal, who is now worried about Hispanic turnout. Willie had the ability to energize people like very few can. That's what we'll lose, unquote. SVREP will continue its current efforts in California, where Hispanic registration lags far behind Texas. San Antonio Mayor Henry Cisneros and other friends of Velazquez also were raising funds for the dead leader's family. When SVREP was hard-pressed for cash, Velazquez let bills slide to avoid cutting staff jobs. One such bill was SVREP's group life insurance. That was Willie, says Villarreal. The cause was everything. So again, the loss of Willie Velazquez was seen as undermining, perhaps, Dukakis' chances in Texas and California, two key electoral states. And again, recall the significance of Texas in the Dukakis electoral strategy. Now, one of the things I wonder about, and again, it is my opinion, I may be wrong, but it is my opinion that after watching about 20 years of untimely cancer deaths in key intelligence or politically related situations, it is my opinion that the death of Willy Velazquez may very well have been a political assassination. What I wonder about, too, is the possible relationship between the loss to the Dukakis campaign of Willy Velazquez and their selection this past week of conservative Texas Senator Lloyd Benson as the Democratic vice presidential nominee. One of the interesting things is that Lloyd Benson is one of four senatorial Democrats who has gone on record as supporting renewed aid to the Contras. With Willy Velazquez out of the picture, one wonders to what extent the Democrats felt compelled to incorporate Lloyd Benson into their program in order to make up for the loss of Willy Velazquez in terms of their southern strategy. It's also interesting to wonder to what extent perhaps reactionary forces may have deliberately sought the nomination of Lloyd Benson, because, again, he has gone on record as supporting Contra aid. If Mike Dukakis should turn out to be a, quote, peacenik, unquote, if he turns out to be another John Kennedy or Jimmy Carter or somebody who will not do the bidding of the national security establishment to the extent that they like, one wonders perhaps whether Mike Dukakis may get low-nutted. You know, some crackpot will just happen to be able to stalk him at the Nashville airport with lots of 28 caliber and 38 caliber and 22 caliber weapons. And if he happens to get picked up, maybe he'll be able to get a $52, $62.50 fine and continue to stalk Michael Dukakis until such point as Michael Dukakis has been terminally low-nutted, so to speak, at which point Hawk Benson will be in a position to assume the mantle, much as LBJ was in a position to assume the mantle of the fallen John F. Kennedy. Recall that at the time of Kennedy's death, he was not only in the process of withdrawing the United States from South Vietnam, he also was working to normalize relations with Cuba's Fidel Castro, who had given indications of wanting to move away from the Soviet Union. Obviously, neither of those initiatives, nor Kennedy's opening of detente with the Soviet Union, nor Kennedy's proposal to break up the CIA into 1,000 pieces during his second term ever came to fruition, because Lyndon Baines Johnson then promptly assumed the presidency, and the rest, as they say, is history. Unfortunately, people don't study that history as closely as they should have, in my estimation. Interesting thoughts concerning the Benson candidacy in the New York Times this past week. This from the New York Times of Friday, July 15th of 1988, a section of Tom Wicker's column, "Will It Work Again?" he asks. Michael Dukakis has taken a high risk in trying to replicate the JFK-LBJ ticket of 1960. Northeast and Southwest, liberal and conservative, by the choice of Lloyd Benson as his running mate. The Democratic Party and American politics, after all, have changed radically in the intervening decades. In 1960, though President Eisenhower had made inroads into the once solidly Democratic South, that region had not yet experienced the great growth of Republican strength among white voters that took place in the 70s and 80s. The Southern black vote then was neither so numerous, so active, nor so monolithically Democratic as it has since become. So Mr. Johnson, a Senate compromiser on civil rights with close ties to such Southern leaders as Richard Russell of Georgia, and thus more identifiably a Southerner than Lloyd Benson, could and did shore up traditional Democratic strength across the South. In 1960, that was largely white, conservative strength. So Tom Wicker asks, will it work again? Dave Emery says, why the hell not? It's worked like a charm for 25 years. If it ain't broke, don't fix it, and it doesn't look like they have. Will it work again? Why not? Like I say, it's been working beautifully for 25 years, even though they're the sorts of intriguing connections and very superficially evident connections, such as the Nazi connections, the World Vision connections, the Bush connections to the Hinckley family. Americans simply exist in a world of myopia with regard to political assassination. A couple of interesting thoughts, too, concerning the death of Willy Velazquez was the fact that he was a close political ally of San Antonio Mayor Henry Cisneros, and there was recently a plot against Cisneros' life. Reviewing an article from last week's show, this from the San Francisco Examiner of June 22nd of 1988, it's a David Broder column headlined "Obit for Willie," and a couple of interesting details here concerning a meeting with Willie Velazquez that David Broder had. Then we talk politics, from the 1988 presidential prospects to the situation of his friend and mayor, Henry Cisneros, of whom he spoke with a wonderful mixture of pride, affection, and critical detachment. He suggested we go on to dinner, but I had another appointment, something I wish I now had canceled. The cancer that killed Willy Velazquez was diagnosed only in the third week of May. He was told he had 6 months to a year, and he called Michael Dukakis, a man he had met while on a brief sabbatical, at the Institute of Politics of Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. He told Dukakis that with whatever time was left, he wanted to go ahead with the plan they'd been discussing for Willie to become the prospective Democratic nominee's deputy campaign manager. 3 weeks later, Dukakis delivered a eulogy at Willie's funeral mass. One of the interesting things is that the Aryan Nations neo-Nazi group and the many splintered American Nazi parties in this country have been used as homme de main by the U.S. national security establishment in the past. They often form what are referred to in intelligence parlance as useful idiots. Namely, they're used at the street level to perform a given task because they do not have, at least to most eyes and in the popular view, any connections to significant people. As we've seen, that is not in fact the case. More importantly, these street Nazis, so to speak, can be done away with at any time. It's just they're not important and they can be disposed of. They are expendable, which makes them very useful. Interesting concerning the recent plot against Henry Cisneros, it took place that this abortive plot was to be directed at Mayor Henry Cisneros by one of these ultra-right-wing tax protesters. Many of those right-wing tax protesters are grouped under the Aryan Nations umbrella network under the former banner of the Posse Comitatus, which last I heard had formally disbanded. There are a lot of these right-wing tax protest groups around, and many of them harbor explicit Nazi elements in their midst, although many of them are also composed by sincere right-wing populists. They're almost all fronts, and regrettably, a lot of the sincere populists wind up being used also as useful idiots and dupes by many of these groups. Reading of this right-wing tax protester's plans to kill Mayor Henry Cisneros, this from the Chronicle of Thursday, May 12th of 1988. A UPI story, Dateline San Antonio headline, Kill for Hire Plot Against Texas Mayor. A tax protester who believes the Constitution gives citizens the right to execute public officials was arrested for trying to hire a hitman to kill San Antonio Mayor Henry Cisneros, authorities said yesterday. Parker Abel, 74, of Natalia, who once ran for Congress on the Libertarian Party ticket and wrote a book, The Two-Faced Nation, was held without bond on a charge of criminal solicitation to commit capital murder, authorities said. Police said he was arrested Tuesday outside a grocery store where he was meeting with an investigator for the Bexar County District Attorney's Office posing as a hitman. Authorities said Abel offered the agent $5,000 plus expenses to kill Cisneros before July 4th. No money changed hands. The arrest followed a month-long investigation begun by the Internal Revenue Service and later joined by the District Attorney's Office and the Texas Rangers. District Attorney Fred Rodriguez said that Abel first approached an IRS investigator and that the IRS contacted his office to get it to continue the probe. The IRS has had Abel under surveillance for years because of his status as a vocally active tax protester, Rodriguez said. Skip Atwell, an investigator for the District Attorney's Office, described Abel as, quote, an individual who believes the Constitution gives citizens the right to remove public officials and that the means can include anything, even execution, unquote. Rodriguez said Abel targeted Cisneros because he is a local politician with national clout whose death would draw attention to Abel's cause. In examining this country's political assassinations, as with the George Lincoln-Rockwell connection to Lee Harvey Oswald, as with the Aryan Nations connections to some of the people involved in the assassination of Robert Kennedy, or apparently involved in the assassination of Robert Kennedy, we've noted that there are numerous Aryan Nations connections to this country's assassinations. Whenever one of this country's major politicians was assassinated in the 60s and 70s, the actual assassination plot was accompanied by numerous abortive threats and plots by elements of the far right, including explicit neo-Nazi groups, at roughly the same period of time. Many of these abortive plots, in my estimation, can be looked upon as being analogous to the types of gases that are formed, that are forced up out of the ground prior to an earthquake by shifting strata. Researching the intelligence community is not unlike seismology in certain respects, in that one must learn to interpret certain signs which are forced to the surface in order to correctly analyze what is going on beneath the surface and outside of the normal purview of one's gaze. And again, I wonder to what extent the obvious ultra-right-wing moves in the direction of Mayor Henry Cisneros, a friend and political ally of Willie Velazquez, may have betokened a general right-wing offensive in the direction of Latino voters and public officials in that part of the country, and perhaps on behalf of George Bush and the National Security Establishment. Reflect on some of the obvious Nazi connections to the Reagan shooting. And again, regrettably, this country's politics have been decided by the bullet rather than the ballot for quite some time, and one thing people should recall is the 1980 election itself, not just its immediate aftermath with the shooting of Ronald Reagan, but the 80 election itself was concretely affected by one certain assassination, and what I believe one was also an assassination, although it was a sudden death, dismissed at the time as natural causes. Nelson Rockefeller died very suddenly in December of 1979 under strange circumstances. Supposedly he died of a heart attack. Interestingly, at the time, he was in the company of a couple of women, one of whom, a woman named Megan Marshak, then turned up in California Defense and Aerospace Circle shortly thereafter. The other one, a woman named Poinchetta Pierce, was working for Reader's Digest, whose editor, John Barron, has done work for the CIA for quite some time. Obviously, those are not conclusive indications, but it is interesting the company that Nelson Rockefeller was keeping when he died. Now, supposedly he died of a heart attack. The paramedics at the time said that his symptoms, he did not appear to have died of a heart attack at all. The discoloration he experienced and other symptoms were inconsistent with a heart attack. However, no autopsy was performed, and the okay to skip an autopsy in the situation came from then New York City medical examiner Dr. Michael Baden, or Baden, B-A-D-E-N, who, intriguingly enough, was called upon as the chief forensic expert by the House Select Committee on Assassinations to examine the so-called single-bullet theory. In the Guns of November, we went over the single-bullet theory and saw that it was not only wrong, but physically impossible in all of its major manifestations, the single-bullet theory representing the evidentiary core of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. The fact that Dr. Michael Baden endorsed the single-bullet theory almost certainly indicates that Dr. Michael Baden himself is willing to work on behalf of the intelligence community. Certainly, it compromises his credibility totally, since the single-bullet theory is utterly preposterous. The indications are there that perhaps Dr. Michael Baden is part of the secret team, part of the assassination mechanism, which has been dispatching American public officials with impunity for, again, the last 25 years or so. Recall in this connection one of the popular aphorisms in the intelligence community, which says that, quote, "Give us the coroner, we'll control the city." Again, give us the coroner, we'll control the city. Many people have felt that Dr. Michael Baden was given to them early on, and that is why he has performed in the manner he has performed in. The second, certainly, as I say, the death of Nelson Rockefeller seems strange. The lack of autopsy, the fact that Baden was assisted on that by Dr. Ernest Eshikoff, a South African physician. The point being that Nelson Rockefeller represented the linchpin of the so-called liberal wing of the Republican Party, if one could speak of the Republican Party in 1979 as having a liberal wing. Certainly he was one of the objects lying in the path, one of the obstacles in the path of a successful Ronald Reagan run at the Republican nomination in 1980. His death in December of 79 eliminated that obstacle. I believe it was an assassination, but again, I may be wrong, and perhaps I'm also wrong about Willie Velasquez. The beauty of assassination by cancer, of course, is that you can't even prove a crime was committed, let alone who committed it. The certain assassination, which had a concrete effect on the 1980 election, was that of Allard Lowenstein, a key aide to the campaign of Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy, and interestingly enough, a person also who had investigated this country's assassinations. Of the Allard Lowenstein assassination, this from the New York Times of Saturday, March 15th of 1980, research credit on this for Mae Brussel. A story continued from the front page called "Allard Lowenstein is Shot, a Former Co-Worker Held." Skipping down on the article, while the doctors worked on Mr. Lowenstein, the state coordinator for Senator Edward M. Kennedy's campaign in New York, Richard Donahue, arrived. He said Mr. Lowenstein was, quote, "a very significant figure," unquote, in the Kennedy campaign. Skipping down, for nearly 4 years in the mid-1960s, according to friends, Mr. Sweeney was married to Mary King, who is now the deputy director of the Peace Corps and the wife of Dr. Peter Bourne, a former aide to President Carter on medical matters. Dr. Peter Bourne was also a key figure involved with neuropsychiatric research for the U.S. Army in Vietnam, one of the people who was involved with President Carter's White House drug policy and was ultimately dismissed for writing a phony prescription for tranquilizers for one of his assistants. Peter Bourne's father, Jeffrey Bourne, has a lot of reactionary connections of long standing. He was head of the Yerkes Primate Center at Emory University, which was involved with AIDS research, went on to become the chancellor of the Grenada Medical School, which not only was used as the pretext for the United States invasion of that country in 1983, but previously, in addition to that, previously, that medical school had been regarded by the regime of Maurice Bishop as being basically a center for U.S. intelligence activities against his government. So the Bourne connection here is fascinating, and the fact that Dennis Sweeney, the man who killed Allard Lowenstein, had connections, the fact that his ex-wife was married to a key Carter staffer and a person who may very well have had intelligence connections is interesting here. At Hinckley's trial, he stated that, quote, "the CIA is in my head. I have radios in my head." In our series on mind control, Radio Free America shows 5, 6, and 7, we went into the CIA and military's successful attempts to develop basically mind control assassins, people who would be forced to commit assassinations against their will and without their subsequent recall. One of the techniques used there, as we looked at, was called RHIC, Radio Hypnotic Intracerebral Control Electronic Dissolution of Memory, which uses a combination of psychosurgery, hypnosis, surgical implantation to create a means of remote control assassination in which the subject then has his memory of the event erased. The principle involved basically uses the implantation of electrodes and the remote control, the electronic remote control of the production of acetylcholinesterase involved with the dissipation of acetylcholine, a key neurotransmitter. Anyway, again, many researchers have felt that Dennis Sweeney, in all probability, was the victim of one of these mind control programs, and the connections to the Carter campaign, which obviously benefited directly from the weakening of the Kennedy campaign by the Lowenstein assassination, again, is one of the many things that people have overlooked. In evaluating the 1980 election, you never, ever hear about the assassination of Alfred Lowenstein, which greatly weakened the Kennedy campaign. Certainly, Ted Kennedy would have been a much more formidable opponent for Ronald Reagan than Jimmy Carter, who was perceived at that point already as a very weak president. One wonders, too, what kinds of messages may have been delivered sub rosa to the Kennedy campaign pursuant to the Lowenstein assassination, whether he was told, listen, we got John, we got Bobby, we just got Allard, and we're damn bloody well going to get you if you don't back off. Again, we don't know, but in light of the campaign of intimidation that was carried on against Mae Brussel on this station and others, listeners to these broadcasts may be in a position to evaluate the kinds of messages which are delivered. Our Italian translator Dave and also myself, to a lesser extent, were subjected to some very interesting goings-on over the course of the last year, and one wonders what kinds of messages may have been delivered to Allard Lowenstein, or to Ted Kennedy concerning the Lowenstein assassination. Again, the primary campaigns themselves have often been affected by assassinations. 1963, John Kennedy was eliminated from the 64 campaign. 1968, Robert Kennedy was eliminated. In 1972, George Wallace was shot and crippled by elements which had direct connections to the Reagan, to the Richard Nixon campaign. Recall that George Wallace was had already talked about running as a third-party candidate, and thereby threatening Richard Nixon's Southern strategy. The bullets which struck him took him out of that particular campaign, and thereby eliminated a possible obstacle to Richard Nixon's re-election. 1976, Gerald Ford, a key member of the Warren Commission, opposed Jimmy Carter. So the assassinations lurk in the background of our elections, just about every one of our elections, for the past 25 years or so. We're now going to take a musical break, and then we're going to come back with one or two other articles, and we should have a little less than an hour for phone calls this evening. One or two other stories I want to touch on in connection with Election 88. The San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, July 14th of 1988, a story Dateline Miami from the Chronicle Wire Services, U.S. charges seven with hiring mercenaries to join Contras. A grand jury indicted the brother of Contra leader Adolfo Calero and six other people, including a conservative from Alabama, on charges of recruiting mercenaries to fight with the Nicaraguan rebels. It was announced yesterday, The long-awaited seven-count indictment returned on June 28th in U.S. District Court in Fort Lauderdale alleged that the seven recruited soldiers of fortune in southern Florida and other parts of the country, quote, to participate in military expeditions and enterprises against the Nicaraguan government, unquote. Skipping down, indicted were Mario Calero, the Contra leader's brother, conservative advocate Thomas Posey of Alabama, Mako Stewart, a wealthy former assistant state attorney general and a 1960-63 state representative in Texas, Jack Terrell, a former mercenary who turned against U.S. Contra policy and has cooperated with the FBI and Congress. Here's the important name now, Jose Coutin, a gun store owner, Alex Martinez, a conservative Miami stockbroker, and Joe Adams, a former bodyguard to Adolfo Calero. Well, Jose Coutin ran the gun shop from which a fellow named Jesus Garcia also operated, and interestingly enough, the weapon used to assassinate Adler Berry Seal, a fellow who allegedly linked the Sandinistas to drug trafficking, but in fact exposed the Medellin cartel and its links to the Contra supply effort. Well, he was assassinated as soon as he exposed the Medellin cartel. The Ingram machine gun used to kill him came from Jose Coutin's gun store. Now, another mercenary involved in the Contra supply, or apparently involved in the Contra supply effort, named Jesus Garcia, when queried by reporters, said that, quote, this is George Bush's baby, unquote, in regard to the Contra supply effort. recalling last week, one of the articles talked about the untimely death of a Nicaraguan Sandinista defector named Baldizón, who had, like Adler Barry Seal, attempted to link the Contras, or the Sandinistas, rather, to drug smuggling and terrorism. We speculated that perhaps his death was part of shutting down the Contra drug supply effort, much like the death of Adler Barry Seal, or basically people who, that like Adler Barry Seal, he had helped unwittingly to point in the direction of Contra drug smuggling, that perhaps his death was similar to that of Adler Barry Seal. So again, Jose Coutin being indicted at this time is potentially, although it'll probably get covered up, is potentially explosive for the Bush campaign. It was his gun store that the weapon used to kill Adler Barry Seal came from. Recall that George Bush in charge of the drug interdiction effort in that part of the country. As we've seen, there's a lot of evidence pointing to his possible involvement as well. An interesting sidelight here, too, is that Tom Posey of the Alabama-based Civilian Materiel Assistance was also indicted. Interestingly enough, not only were they apparently involved in the Contra supply effort, according to a lot of different sources, but in, I believe it was 1986 or perhaps 85, members of Posey's group drew a lot of national attention and a lot of criticism for their paramilitary efforts around the Texas-Mexican border. Or I guess maybe it was in New Mexico or Arizona. But in large areas of a number of areas in the Southwest, Posey's group were actually functioning as de facto border guards. They were going around armed and stopping Mexican refugees into the United States on the pretext that they were illegals and doing all sorts of unconstitutional and thoroughly illegal things. It drew a lot of attention and criticism at the time, but this was before the Iran-Contra scandal broke, and in particular before the Christic Institute suit brought forth some of the information concerning the Rex 84 martial law contingency plan, which, in the event of a U.S. invasion of Nicaragua, which the elements of the Contra supply effort had hoped to provoke with the proposed assassination bombing of U.S. Ambassador to Costa Rica, Louis Tams, which would then have been based, blamed on the Sandinistas, and served as the pretext for a U.S. invasion of Nicaragua. In response to this and the inevitable protests, contingency plans were drawn up to intern some 400,000 Central American refugees in detention camps in the United States under a martial law plan, which was to be known as Rex 84. We speculated that Rex 84 represented an updating of the King Alfred plan, a contingency plan to eliminate basically all black Americans. This based not only on the similarities between the King Alfred plan and the Rex 84 plan, but also primarily on a key article from the Miami Herald, July 5, 1987, by Alfonso Chardy, which stated specifically that the martial law plan with regard to the Central American refugees was based on a similar plan drawn up by Luis Sufrida during his work at the National War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. All of that in Radio Free America 32. So again, the Posey border vigilante actions in 85 and 86 should perhaps be reflected on again against the background of Rex 84 and the martial law plans. Also, with regard to Election 88, we've speculated in the past that the Tawana Brawley case in New York City may very well have been being manipulated by elements of the far right and the intelligence community in order to alienate black people from the establishment political process just at the very time when they potentially could exert their greatest individual role on that process, or individual in a sense as an individual group, as a distinct, their greatest distinct role in that process because of the Jackson candidacy. And again, I'm extremely critical of Jesse Jackson and also, frankly, very suspicious of him, but the phenomenon of the Jackson campaign, I think, has a much greater significance than anything to do with the individual personality of Jesse Jackson himself, and I think that's a distinction I want to make sure to draw so that people understand it. I am extremely critical and very suspicious of Jesse himself. That does not mean, however, that the Jesse Jackson candidacy, its significance at the grassroots level and its significance for future electoral campaigns is not very significant indeed, and I suspect that elements manipulating the Tawana Brawley case and now perhaps a new similar incident in New York may very well be working on behalf of the national security establishment to alienate black voters from the political process, thereby strengthening the Bush candidacy and weakening the Democrats. There is a new similar case to the Tawana Brawley case in New York City. Recall that in this regard, Al Sharpton, the Reverend Al, who has garnered a lot of the publicity in the case by becoming sort of personal advisor to the Brawley family, not only has been cited by Warren Hinkle of the San Francisco Examiner Chronicle as a CIA agent and specifically one who worked in Grenada in the early 1980s, but also by his own admission as an FBI informant. A strange thing, as Niptuck noted some weeks back, for a man who wears a medallion of Martin Luther King around his neck. Reading from the Chronicle of Saturday, July 16th of 1988, a UPI story from Kingston, New York, headlined, Brawley's Advisors Take on a New Case. Two civil rights advocates charged yesterday that the police department of this city, this, by the way, is Dateline Kingston, New York, that the police department of this city is a Klan den, unquote, and said that they will investigate the killing of a black woman who was found with the letters KKK carved into her body. The Reverend Al Sharpton and lawyers C. Vernon Mason said that the killing was part of a pattern that included the alleged abduction and rape of Tawana Brawley, a black teenager from nearby Wappingers Falls, and the Kingston Police Department cannot fairly investigate the beating and strangulation death of Anna Kithcart. However, both the Kingston police chief and Kithcart's father said they believe that her death may have been related to drugs. Kithcart's naked body was found by a homeless man behind a Kingston hospital on Wednesday morning. "This place is a Klan den," said Sharpton, a Brawley family advisor. "We plan to find out exactly what happened," added Mason, an attorney for the Brawley family. And so on and so forth. I wonder whether the death of Anna Kithcart, 19, again, it was found with KKK carved into her body, may represent deliberately, someone who deliberately created fodder for C. Vernon Mason and Al Sharpton. Certainly this will give them new ammunition in their what appears to be very provocative campaign in the New York area. And recall that elements of Louis Farrakhan's organization have also been very active, not only with regard to the Tawana Brawley case, but also exacerbating hostile relations between the Jewish and black communities in the Chicago area and elsewhere. Recall that we've taken a look in the past at possible connections of Louis Farrakhan to the assassination of Malcolm X and the documented connections between Farrakhan and his organization and the Aryan Nation's neo-Nazi network, an institution which elements of which award points to their Aryan warriors, quote-unquote, for the killing of black people. Again, the Farrakhan association with the Aryan Nations seems extraordinary. I personally find it impossible to accept any black person's association with an organization that advocates the extermination of black people. It just doesn't click, and appears to me, as I've said before, to be closely analogous to the situation of the Jews in Germany during World War II and prior to, when elements of the Jewish community, notably the Beitarim, the revisionist Zionists, explicit fascist elements of Zionism, notably headed by Menachem Begin, literally cooperated with the SS for a period of time because they saw Britain as a more dangerous enemy to long-term Zionist interests. I think that Farrakhan's organization is functioning in a similar capacity on behalf of black Americans. So, stay tuned now for Mrs. Peel, who will bring you some of the finest in various kinds of sounds. My name is Dave Emery, Fornip Tuck, saying thanks for listening, tune in next week, and take care of yourselves.